Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We begin the show today by talking with the authors of the book, A Wing and a Prayer, The Race to Save Our Vanishing Birds. Joining us today, Beverly and Anders Gyllenhaal. They are veteran journalists who have worked for decades as reporters and editors. Beverly was a feature writer, food editor, syndicated columnist, and author. Beverly, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Well, Larry, I'm thrilled to be here. Thanks so much for having us.
I'll tell you what, it's great to have you here. Anders Gyllenhaal was an investigative reporter at the Miami Herald. After that, he led newsrooms in Raleigh, Minneapolis, Miami, and Washington. Anders, thank you for joining us as well.
Oh, thanks, Larry. It's great to have a chance to talk with you.
They are both dedicated birders who have traveled more than 25,000 miles across the U.S. to chronicle the cutting-edge technologies, the contentious politics, and the conservation approaches to saving our vanishing birds. And it's a fascinating book. And as we talk with them, I hope you'll join in with your own thoughts and comments. Number to call, 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you could send an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Well, you've been birders for a while. What enticed you into getting in your Airstream and traveling 25,000 miles across the country the way you did, and then writing a book about it?
Well, the first thing was we both grew up with birds in the backyard, and then as we lived downtown Washington, D.C. in a high-rise condo surrounded by concrete, we needed to get out into nature. So we bought first a little fiberglass bubble, and we would go around the national parks and other parks on the eastern shore and up in the mountains of Virginia. And we started seeing birds everywhere, and we didn't know what they were. So Anders was a photographer, and he started snapping pictures. And at night, we'd pore through the birding guides to see what they were. So we're those people whose hobbies sort of took over their lives. So if you fast forward 10 years, we'd given up our condo, and our work life was slowing down. And so we spent about half the year going from one wildlife refuge to another, one park to another, and really chasing birds. And so that's basically the background of how we got into birds. And Anders,
in 2019, I think you mentioned this in some of the material, that a really interesting discovery occurred where scientists figured out that we have lost a third of the bird population in North America. And that was just such a profound point. We said, what is going on and what can be done about it? We thought that there was a book here. So that's what led us to take off and take on this journey and this topic.
It had to be a fascinating trip. It's a fascinating book, by the way. I learned quite a bit. I mean, I've talked about birds for a long time on this show and just my own interests in it, but I was fascinated by some of the I was horrified by some of the problems that are out there, but I was also fascinated by some of the different techniques that people are using to address problems across the country with birds and help make them better. And I was really fascinated with that. You know, the whole business of 3 billion birds, how do they figure that out? And you do talk about that in the book, and maybe just explain a little bit about how scientists know the bird population is declining to that degree.
Right. And this is a really interesting part of the kind of the foundation of this, is that for years, it was just rough estimates, just kind of guesses. Researchers would go out and listen to birds and have to just watch them. And they're really hard. Birds are always trying to get away from us, right? And they basically are hidden away most of the time. But what they did was they combined what are new capabilities of radar, the weather radar, which you're trying to capture rainfall, but it also captures birds. And they figured out how to follow the migrations and count that way. And they compared those against traditional bird counts that have been happening for 50 years. And then a lot of, you know, state-of-the-art computations led them to realize there's about 10 billion birds in North America, breeding birds, at the height of the breeding season in the springtime. And that was the basis on which they figured out, wait a minute, a third of them have gone habitat loss and climate shifting, and then just sort of urban hazards of killing billions of birds, 3 billion altogether were lost, is their conclusion.
You know, it might be worth it before we go any deeper to give our give us a sort of a thumbnail sketch of the book itself. Then we'll get into more of the particulars of it. Could you do that?
Well, it sort of all comes down to how do birds get saved in the country? How does this happen? And this turned out to be a lot more complicated than we would have originally thought. So we ended up talking with more than 300 people from every different segment of the bird world. It turns out there are 11 different federal agencies that have oversight or some degree of oversight of birds. And there are, of course, each state has its state and wildlife folks. There's even local groups. And, of course, there are the nonprofits such as Audubon and the American Bird Conservancy, the Nature Conservancy that have traditionally been involved as well. And, of course, the lab of the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, which is one of the biggest players. And so Anders, tell us about how we went from there.
Right. So the question was, what is being done to save birds? And so the book goes through a series of different really fascinating projects, sometimes using technology, sometimes using new conservation techniques on agriculture, for instance. How do birds and farmers coexist? A really interesting phenomenon. There's a fascinating project in California where they're using the science of sound combined with artificial intelligence to figure out where the California spotted owl is and what can be done to try to save them because they're under stress across the Nevada, the Sierra Nevada range. And then Hawaii, there's a huge project that's trying to deal with the loss of native forest birds that are disappearing because of an avian malaria that's spreading up into the mountains. So we tell each of these stories as we travel across through the book and across the country. And then we get into the questions of, well, what can be done and what does the future look like? And that's, of course, the key question that is the book is aimed at. And what, in the end, what can average people do? And there's a lot. We'd love to talk about that a little bit, because this is an area, this is a part of the overall environmental story, obviously. But it's a discrete slice of that where there is a lot of remedies and actions that are within reach, we say in this book, that can help to slow down what has been, you know, a sort of a seismic loss of birds.
Yeah. And you mentioned technology, you mentioned spotted owls. That reminded me that there's a Wisconsin connection right there with Connor Wood, Madison, Wisconsin person who was involved in what's called bioacoustics and the sounds of the spotted owls.
You know, this was one of the largest sound research efforts like this in the world at the time that that Connor took this on. And what they do is they basically track the owls in multiple different ways. But they found that if they use these sound recorders coupled with artificial intelligence that could go through thousands and thousands of hours of recordings, and the artificial intelligence would be able to actually pick up the sound, the specific hoot of the owl. So they would know where the owls were going, where they were, because this mountain range is just massive. And of course, if you don't know where a bird is, and what trouble it might run into along the way, then you can't save it.
And one of the really interesting things about the spotted owl story is, of course, we'll remember that the northern spotted owl was one of the most difficult conservation controversies in modern history, where in the northwest, the spotted owl was pitted against the lumber industry, and decades of arguments and violence and sabotage unfolded over whether to protect the owl or protect loggers. So the California spotted owl was sort of going down the same path. And what we found so interesting was that with technology and with the U.S. Forestry Service, which is leading this, found a way to sort of redo this story with a much more promising ending, because at this point, the spotted owl deal stabilized. There's, of course, a catch to this,
yeah.
Which is one of the big threats to the spotted owl with the invasive barred owls coming in from the east. So they had to make a choice. Do you keep the spotted owl, or does the barred owl come in and kill off the spotted owls, which are the barred owls are much more powerful and were winning that battle. So what they ended up having to do was to kill the invasive barred owl in order to protect the spotted owl.
And you can imagine that this was not a very popular decision. But, so many of us in the East have barred owls right in our yard. We actually have what we call our personal barred owl. But the minute that owl crosses over to the other part of the country, it's essentially an invasive species. And so making this choice to basically arm and go after the barred owl was difficult. But if they were going to save this endangered bird, it's what they had to do.
Yeah, it's an amazing story, and I like barred owls, too. We've got barred owls here in Wisconsin, and people like barred owls. So it kind of, in a way, rubs you. I mean, intellectually, you understand.
Right.
Well, it's worth saying, though, that the reason for preserving this owl is that it's kind of the key fabric in the Sierras to making the whole thing work. And the Sierras supply California's water, in effect, through the snow melt. And so if the spotted owl isn't healthy, and the mountains aren't healthy, and the watershed isn't healthy, California is not healthy. That's part of the bigger picture.
Yeah. And, you know, just overall, and as you point out, there is no overall solution to the loss of there's so many birds that species that have are almost extirpated, but you can't come up with a single way to resolve the issue.
Well, you know, Larry, if you've seen one bird, you've seen one bird, because each of these birds evolved in a particular type of habitat. And this was one of the things that surprised us a lot, but also delighted us when you realize how complex a bird can be. For example, there's the golden-cheeked warbler that lives really near Fort Hood in Texas, and it can only weave its nest from the bark strands of the ash juniper tree. And the amount of land that still harbors ash juniper trees is very, very small. So you're battling something there with that bird that may be is completely different from, say, the whooping crane that's in the bayou of Louisiana and travels, I believe, up to your territory or pretty close to.
Yeah, we used to have about 80 of them in Wisconsin at one point.
But the solution, of course, is to recognize these differences and to work on them. And that's kind of what the story of the book is, how these different characters in all different settings are working on trying to find those solutions to coexist with birds. That's kind of one of the messages here.
Yeah.
We can coexist if we'll do some things that recognizes we both have needs.
Anders and Beverly Gyllenhaal are guests today. Their book is titled A Wing and a Prayer, The Race to Save Our Vanishing Birds. Callers online, and we'll get to you in just a minute, as a matter of fact, but there's one open line at 800-642-1234, or shoot us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Tyler Ditter is our engineer today. Clara Neipert, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. taking a look at the book of Wing and a Prayer, The Race to Save Our Vanishing Birds, with the authors Anders and Beverly Gyllenhaal. Great to have them with us. We'll take some calls. Jeff and Madison, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I heard you guys talking about what people might do to help out. And there's a project right out of Madison here at the Arboretum called Journey North, which has something like 40 to 50,000 volunteers across North America who enter data on, it's really a tracking migrations, monarch butterflies, but also a number of birds like I know the loon, red-winged blackbirds, hummingbirds, and other migrating species. And citizens, scientists track their first sighting of the year, enter the data, and the maps are provided online at Journey North. So it's kind of an interesting project that anyone can participate in. And
yeah. And Anders and Beverly both write about it.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. The whole role of citizen science is particularly effective with birds because, you know, we see them and they speak to us, in effect. So there's a lot of different tools. eBird, where people can track birds and contribute to Cornell's database. The MODIS towers spreading across both this hemisphere and others, where we are tracking birds through radio tags and sort of along the lines of what you're talking about. So that one of the things we get into in this book is how very impactful this can be for that research. But it also has the impact of turning regular folks into, you know, conservation-oriented players, because, you know, the more you learn about birds, the more interested we become, and the more we want to try to do some of the things like your project that can help them. Thank you for that comment.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff. Appreciate it. Linda and Wanakee will give you a chance. Hi, Linda.
Hi. Thank you for doing the hard work of researching and writing this book. I almost turned the program off because it seems so discouraging, but that's a very poor attitude. So what my husband and I are currently doing, we provide clean water year-round. We have a bluebird house and feed the hummingbirds. Our property, for the most part, is either prairie or woods. The only thing that I can think of, that we haven't really planted any bushes that would provide food, like with berries, year round. I don't know if you have other suggestions for us. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, Linda.
Well, I'm sure. Beverly, you ought to talk about the military role because I can't, in some ways that's a model for what can be done to try to respond to Linda's point of, is this pressing? Well, the whole point of the book was to say there are solutions, both what individuals can do and some of the institutions can do, that are making a huge difference.
And I like the case study idea because it does give us some clear pictures. And I think that military, the case study, too, was about the military.
Yes, and we had absolutely no idea that the military manages more endangered species and at higher densities than any other agency. And the reason for this is because as the country developed, military bases, the 500 of them across the country, remain very much undisturbed in their buffers. They take up hundreds of acres, thousands of acres of land. And for the most part, that land is natural, just the way it was. So, of course, you say, if you build it, they will come. Well, if you leave it alone, they are there. And so we visited, in particular, Fort Benning, where the military is working on the red-cockaded woodpecker. And essentially, this is a little, it seems like an ordinary bird. But talking about your particular birds, this may be the pickiest bird in the country. It can only build its nest in a 100-year-old longleaf pine tree, and then it takes the bird about 10 years to build the nest. And so as these old-growth 100-year-old trees are disappearing, military bases is where they still were. So as the bird began to fade, there was a whole team of researchers They actually call them the Woodpecker Nation because these scientists have built their entire careers on the backs of the red-cockaded woodpecker. But they eventually figured out that if they could install an artificial nest box inside the tree, then the woodpecker would just move right in. So what you find at Fort Benning, Fort Bragg, and all of the 15 different military bases through the South that manage for these red-cockaded woodpeckers, you'll find that they're flourishing there. They just built the boxes, put them in the trees, and voila, the birds are doing their part. The military also has the advantage of having a big budget to spend, to have very little bureaucracy to contend with, to get the job done. And so what they do is they'll take a particular bird, they'll go out and issue grants for people to study the absolute specifics of what this bird needs in order to thrive. But, you know, the other interesting thing is that the military does not consider itself a conservation organization, and they're very upfront about that. Their job is to prepare an adequate armed forces and ensure the security of the country. And if they need to train on a particular patch of land, if this bird is essentially in their way, if you want to put it that way, then they need to recover the bird, make sure that it's no longer endangered. They will relocate families and clusters of these birds to different areas on the base. And essentially, they can get back to training as usual if they do this.
The interesting thing is that we found, well, if the military can save birds in the middle of bombing ranges and runways and, you know, and marching battalions, then we ought to be able to do it elsewhere. It's kind of one of the things we took away from that experience.
Yeah, for sure. And they were using local plant. I mean, they left things as they were, as kind of as you were saying, Beverly. But that means they were using the local plants. And so I'm thinking now about Linda and Wanakee, who has, what else can I do? And I think native.
So we didn't answer that very well, did we? The book has a whole compendium at the end of things, 22 different things that people can do. And of course, some of them are obvious, putting in native plants and bird feeders in your backyard, avoiding pesticides. Mm-hmm. It's amazing how one, you know, yard that will take those kind of steps will be full of birds, where the one next to it that doesn't will not have birds. So it has an immediate impact that people can have a real difference in this.
It does. Linda, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And, Chris in Black Creek, we'll go to you. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Larry. Great show to you and your guests. I'm going to try and make this quick. So I'm glad that your guest, she mentioned a warbler. I was sitting in my barnyard, and a warbler was carrying something pretty big, 12 feet above, and dropped it in my gravel driveway. And then it landed, and it started pecking at it. And I walked over there, and the warbler flew away. And I looked, and here was a little pink baby with its eyes still closed. I didn't know what kind of bird that hatched out of the egg, but I looked at it, and I was like, oh, okay, well, you know, they always say let nature take its course. Well, so I walked away. 2 hours later, I went over there, and there were like 25, 30 some little brown ants on it, and it was still alive, and I walked away. Well, then in the evening, it was cold and cool, and I walked out there in my barn light, and there were like 70 some brown ants on it. And the poor thing was sitting there.
So you picked it up?
Its legs trying. I am? Oh.
So okay, you picked it up?
No, yes. Actually, I yelled out loud in my barnyard, that's enough of this. And I bent down and took a deep breath and blasted. I'm trying to make this story quick and short. And I blew all the ants off of that little baby, and it opened its mouth at me as if the wind from my breath were like the wings of their its parents coming to feed it, and it opened its mouth. So I scooped it up. I warmed it in the palm of my hands. Larry, I'm trying to make this short.
Well, you raised that bird is the story here, Chris. And so that's an individual. Now, it's not even, I'm not sure, in some cases it might not even be technically legal to do that. But just a comment on, here's an individual approach.
Yeah, sure. Well, I think the instincts that you're showing, Chris, are what's important, is that, you know, these days the birds are in effect in our hands in ways that they haven't been in the past. For, you know, millennium, we've been able to take birds for granted. But now we're at a point where all sorts of things are working against them, and we have to decide, are we willing to do some of the things? I'm not necessarily talking about whether a baby bird should be picked up, because that's not our expertise, and you're supposed to let nature take its course, as you say. But the instinct of trying to help is the thing that we're trying, you know, to put a focus on. And so I appreciate what you're saying and what you tried to do here. If we apply that more broadly, I think we'll all be better off.
Yeah. Another of your case studies involved a very successful group that there's controversy around from time to time, and that's Ducks Unlimited.
Yeah. Beverly, you probably have a view of this.
Well, Ducks Unlimited, I have to say first that Ducks Unlimited got its original start in North Carolina, which happens to be my home state. And duck hunting along the coast of North Carolina stretches back to the 1800s, and it just brings in people from all over the country come here. And I know they also go up into the Prairie Pothole region in your neck of the woods as well. I come from a family of hunters, and I am not a hunter myself, but I was always around the tradition. But what I didn't know, I never knew, is that hunters were pretty much solely responsible, along with the federal government, for recovering the waterfowl after the drought of the 1930s. So what happened was these industrialists, very wealthy people from New York, would come down to North Carolina and hunt. And one of them in particular just figured out that, hey, you know, we can go up in airplanes. We can count the ducks. We can figure out how to preserve where they need to have migratory stopovers and that sort of thing. And this original effort over the years blossomed into Ducks Unlimited. But it also evolved into the National Wildlife Refuge System, which now consists of over 550 refuges all around the country that not only help migratory waterfowl, but also are oases for many other types of birds and all types of wildlife. So this is sort of a legacy that hunters have given to the country. And I knew about hunting, but I did not know about this extensive chain of preservation that's been going on since the 30s. And
yeah, so the Pittman-Robertson Act, you know, the federal act, would hunters essentially pay for that through taxes on firearms, shells, you name it. And I'm wondering.
That's an interesting point. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
One thing that what that has done was enabled, I think it's $17 billion has been raised through ammunition and bows and arrows and gun sales that has created a funnel of funds that goes into conservation. What hasn't happened is a similar way of producing the revenue, perhaps from sales of binoculars and cameras and all the equipment that people need to watch birds. They try
not to mention the four billion
dollars in bird seed.
Yeah.
So we need to be willing to put some money into this. And in fact, there's a piece of important legislation before Congress right now, the Restoring America's Wildlife Act. It's passed the House, not the Senate. It's pending. Would help to provide funds for some of these species that have never gotten the benefits of ducks and geese and the military funding. A really important thing that could right now make a lot of difference.
Yeah. I've told people, birders sometimes, if you want to help, a cheap way to help would be to buy a federal duck stamp.
Yeah, absolutely.
But they look at me like I'm crazy sometimes. Oh, why would I want to support something that leads to shooting? But overall, we wouldn't have the population of ducks and other wildlife bird species without.
Right.
Without that, I wanted the case study three that you had involved rethinking conservation. And that's led to some interesting work, I thought. Maybe talk a bit about that.
Yes. Yeah. Well, so what happened was, sorry, go ahead, Beverly.
No, you go ahead.
So what happened was the same scientist who did the 3 billion bird research got together in Washington after they had put this news out and said, you know, we just can't stop at reporting this. We need to do something. So they put together a group of researchers from all across the country and said, what can we do to dig into these species that are in trouble, the ones that we don't know about, and try to tackle their problems before they reach the extinction stage, and that's so often been our tradition. So they're raising $50 million. They're arranging for scientists to dig into, well, why is this bird or that bird in trouble? They've chosen four sort of test pilots to go after grosbeak, lesser legs, a warbler, and a wading bird, and say, if we can figure out what's preventing this bird from breeding or migrating, we can save them. And so it's really an interesting experiment that we think has, you know, we've found a lot of promise, but it also kind of raises the question of why does a startup have to do this so late in the game? Why don't we have a more practical wing of research that's available? So it's a real good challenge for the status quo to say, how are we going to save birds? Well, we need to know where they are, what they're doing, and what they need. And so we'll watch this very closely to see how it turns out.
And the real impetus behind this is that there is an avalanche headed toward the Endangered Species Act. More than 50%, close to 60% of bird species in North America are in decline, some of them perilously close to being at the edge of extinction. And the scientists realized that although we have the Endangered Species Act, which is the gold standard law for conservation in the world, this act was passed in the 1970s, 1973 to be exact, so it's 50 years old this year. It is a good thing, but it was built for an earlier era. So now the endangered species list is getting more and more crowded, to the point where some of the birds that Road to Recovery is interested in are backlogged. They can't get on the list because it's too crowded. There isn't room on the list. And so it really does bring home the point that, yes, we take care of the most endangered birds. For example, the Florida grasshopper sparrow was down to 22 breeding pairs of birds before scientists finally settled on a solution, which was to bring in healthy birds, the last few, from the Florida dry prairie and breed them in captivity. But waiting until there are 24, well, until there are 44 birds left, that's an expensive and tough operation at that point.
Yeah, it is indeed. There are other novel things. I do want to go back, though, to what can people do a bit, because you do offer a number of things. You know, Anders, you mentioned a few earlier.
Yeah.
Maybe something as simple as maple syrup.
Yeah, talk about that, Beverly, because that's fun.
Well, so there is a movement in Vermont for maple syrup producers to leave native plants in their groves and around their trees, and so they are producing bird-friendly maple syrup. And you're not going to be able to necessarily go into your grocery store and buy this, but in the book we talk about lots and lots of different options for mail ordering directly from these producers. These are the kinds of things that are just now being developed and just now taking hold. There's also bird-friendly beef, and there is bird-friendly coffee. And so what you eat can make a difference. But, you know, one of our favorite conversations about this was with a researcher at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. And she said, you know, don't make perfect be the enemy of the good. If you can't get hold of bird-friendly coffee, for example, choose organic coffee because that is readily available. And what's happening is that this bird-friendly designation, again, means the farms in South America are keeping the native plants. So this sort of circles back to Linda's original question. And her head and heart are in the right place with this native plants. And, you know, Larry, I know you do a garden talk show on Fridays. And this, I think, you might have already done this, but it would be a wonderful topic to bring up. Because you can go online and you can find, you know, all of the list of native plants for your zone. And most really good garden shops would be able to help you with that as well. And it can take a little effort and it can take a little time, but the payoff for the birds is really big. And it multiplies the more people that do this.
And other quick things you can do, very important, is to keep your cats indoor. Cats kill billions of birds every year. Windows collisions are a big thing. We list all different solutions to glass, big glass windows that birds smash into. About a billion birds die that way. Lights out in cities. Push your city, if it doesn't have one now, a lights out program, which just turns down the high-rise lights that confuse birds during migration. Only has to happen for a couple of weeks during the migration season. It can have a lot of impact. So we go through all these different things that both individuals and institutions can do, which would make a huge difference.
Yeah. And, boy, we haven't – there are so many novel approaches that are being tried that you talk about in your book that we haven't covered, but here we are out of time. Anders and Beverly have written a fascinating book, and I want to thank you for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it.
Great to be here. Thank you, Larry. Wonderful.
Really. Yes, thank you so much for having us.
Anders and Beverly Gyllenhaal, our guest today, and their book is titled A Wing and a Prayer. That's the main title. And then the subtitle, The Race to Save Our Vanishing Birds. Take a look at it. I think you're going to be amazed at some of the things that are being done. There are some things, you know, the purple martin is a bird here in Wisconsin that is in some trouble. And we're going to talk about that next. What's being, what are the purple martins like and what's being done to keep them here in our state with our next guest. Russ Hefty joins us next. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.